This is what I want to do, though, is I want to take some time reflecting on Rodney Stark's book. I want to summarize what it is that I saw, and then I want to, well, in a sense, I want to give us an altar call from an atheist, okay? So let's reflect on Rodney Stark's book. What was it that struck you about his book? You turned in the report on Friday. What was it that struck you about what it was? It is a different type of a book. It is not devotional. It is more academic. But what was interesting about it? What stood out? Sage?
Their selflessness. They're not really their care about what happened to themselves. They just cared about other people.
Yeah, there was a recklessness to the early church.
It was pretty good. I was like, man, I wish the church would kind of try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, what would it look like if the American church recaptured the selflessness of the early church? The recklessness, the reckless selflessness. How would that apply to things like Syrian refugees? How would that apply to things, you know? I mean, you could go down the list. Kirsten.
I think, just growing up in the church, there's a lot of generalizations like Christians were different than other people, or like Christians helped people. Like the book was like very specific in detail. And so, like, just like culturally, that made a lot more sense.
Uh huh. Absolutely, yeah. We do that a lot. Like, you just not be in the world, but not of the world. And it's like, and that's true, and that's helpful, but it's so vague that sometimes you're just like, all right, so I just need to be nice to people. And it's like, well, I mean, yeah, but it's so vague. Yeah, and what this book does is it says, no, let's talk exactly what they were doing. Why is it that they stood out in the world they were living in? And the examples that he gives are startling, startling. Corey, what stood out to you?
One of the biggest things that stuck out to me was the difference between the way women were treated throughout the empire and the way that the church began to treat women.
Yeah.
And I was it was like one of the things that made me the most proud of the church.
Huh.
Because it's like in today's society, we almost have this, it's kind of true, this stigma of putting women down and things like that. And it's like, we need to realize that we were one of the first groups to stand up for women, and we need to stands up and promotes women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, and it's just horrific, like looking at one of the biggest things that shocked me was like how all the different types of abortion and how dangerous it was, and thinking about like abortion today and how it's almost just like we made it a little bit prettier and nicer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are dead on. The way in which he articulates the early church's interaction with women is startling in comparison to what our reputation is today. It's startling, startling. Now, I will say our reputation today, some of the things are unjustified of what's being accused. Some of the things are not generally true, but that reputation's not generally false either. And there's every society presents a new set of stigmas for the church that we should figure out how to selflessly and recklessly engage to bring unique moments of justice. We can say we're in the world, not of the world, that actually sets the stage for 2,000 years from now. A book's written about the way the church in America was functioning, and people are overwhelmed because it convicts them the way that we were functioning. Good. Kyla?
I think just an aspect that I had never heard before, it was like more of a sociological aspect than mm-hmm. a theological aspect,
mm-hmm.
but about like their treatment of women and how it affected their population as well. Like the secular world, there was a lot of infanticide with mm-hmm. Female babies because they were viewed as like, oh, they can't carry on her family name, and they can't fight for the family,
yeah.
and they can't bring the family honor, so just leave them to the elements. Well, the Christians would take in those female mm-hmm. babies, and females, you have to have females to make babies. So
sure.
It was really, like,
and at the same time,
that sociological yeah. aspect of it, like, that no one really ever points out, mm-hmm. but it's just extreme.
Absolutely. And at the same time, the Christians didn't look at women as their only value is by producing babies. Mm-hmm. They had unique roles, very fascinating roles. Like, for example, we're going to allow us to talk about this. I'm going to repeat some of what you're saying, but in a more linear fashion so that we can have this wash over us again as we talk about restoring this last relationship through these three lenses, all flowing from this, okay? But one of the things that that is fascinating to me, and I think this came out in Rodney Stark's book, I can't remember, was that women, widows, a lot of times wealthy widows, would refuse to remarry so that they could use their wealth to take care of the poor. And then their daughters would end up having perpetual virginity in order to use their money and sacrifice themselves for the betterment of other people, which is much different. In other words, it's going like, listen, women, the only way in which you have value is not through birthing. The service of the church is multitudinous, and we need everyone engaged in it. And the early church did a good job of paying attention to all of the value of all of the people around them and utilizing that for the advancement of the kingdom in a crazy, startlingly unique way. And we're just, I mean, honestly, my theme for this lecture is we need to be more creative in the church today. That's our problem. We're not creative enough. Matter of fact, I'll be honest, even a lot of people that come to Ozark, whenever they come to Ozark, it's almost like they think I'm either a youth minister, a worship minister, or a preaching minister. And I'm like, you're not creative enough. Like, there are so many other ministries that you can be trained for. Besides, I mean, I'm not saying those three are bad. I'm just saying those aren't the only three ministries. I'm like, there are so many needs in this world. And there are so many ways to do it. We just aren't creative enough. Instead, we're going to spend, I'll be honest with you, one of the things I think we've made a mistake is actually arguing about women's roles. Now, I mean, you know my stance on the women's roles issue, I think. If not, I'll just summarize it for you. We aren't actually doing what the early church was doing when it comes to women's roles. Are we allowed to let the woman pass the plate? What? We're really going to have a conversation about this? This is crazy. As if our God is a legalistic warmonger that is looking for a mistake like that, or corruption of the Lord's Supper like that to damn our whole church, or to damn that woman. I'm going, come on. We're just not even, but I'll be honest, when we get so focused, this is the danger. Now, I speak out about what I think about women's roles, and I'll be honest with you, I'm comfortable with a woman being in any role. The only one that I hesitate is elder. And here's the reason why. We just don't have any evidence in the first 400 to 500 years of the church of a woman being an elder. But every other position in the church, we have evidence of a woman being. Even in the second, third century, we have a woman that's referred to as an apostle, a small a apostle, where she was sent with a message. We have prophetesses, we have deaconesses, you name it. And we have a woman playing that role, except for elder. And there could be sociological reasons for that, but there also could be theological ones. This is one of my big push on the whole women's roles is this. We need to start treating women better by being more creative with what it is that we have as roles in the church and being a little bit less restrictive. However, I will not buy into the myth that women and men contribute the exact same thing to the body. I don't buy that. Like my big pushback against the feminist movement is not, no, you can't stop fighting for women's rights. I'm like, no, you need to, because even if we're talking the secular world from payment, it is not the same world for women. And that needs to be rectified because their value is equal to men, their value. But one of the things I don't like about the feminist movement is they say, men and women are exactly the same. That's not true. And I am thankful for that. I am glad that men and women are not exactly the same. And in the church, what we need to be able to do is to have both. To elevate the status of women to the value that they actually deserve. Stop being afraid of allowing women to use their gifts for the kingdom, but also respect the fact that we're not the same. And that's what makes it wonderful. I mean, that's even the reason why, well, I don't want to get off. The whole point is, the way the early church engaged women was they actually looked at them as a part of the image of God, a gift to the church that was creatively utilized in a multitude of ways in order to destroy the kingdom of Satan. We need to be more creative, not just in the women's roles, but of how to attack all the issues in our society. Our society is waiting for a church that's more creative. And that to me is what the early church was. They were creative in their recklessness of their selflessness. I mean, they were selfless in a way that's just startling. But that selflessness caused them to be infinitely creative. And so they were able to attack every issue without a one-track way of attacking the issue. So let me give you an example. Children. That was one of the major categories Rodney Stark brings up. The way that the church interacts with children in the ancient world was weird. I mean, it was strange. This type of a verse would have been startling in a Roman setting. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress. Orphans? Widows? In the ancient world, as you guys have read, children were treated like trash. I mean, they were parasites. I mean, and that metaphor is really important. What a parasite does is it latches onto a host, and all that it does is suck things out of the host. It merely draws from. It does not give back. And children were like that. When it comes to an honor-shame society, all that children were liabilities. They could lose honor. Very rarely could they bring it in. And I'm talking male and female children here. Male children one day would be able to contribute, but while they were children, they were a burden with the hope of honor being retained or even maybe incrementally gathered. But female children? Oh. In the ancient world, they were treated. There was a letter in Adolf Deichmann's book, A Light from the Ancient East. And it's a letter that he found. You know, I mean, what he does is the whole argument of the book is to basically say, in order to do New Testament scholarship well, we should be paying attention to the way in which the common person was communicating to each other. So receipts that would have been thrown out after somebody bought something, let's look at those and see how it impacts our understanding of the New Testament. One of the things he found was a scratched out letter from a father to his wife that was pregnant, and he was on business. And he sends the letter back and he says, you know, I'm working as hard as I can to make it home. He says, if you have the child before I get there, if it's a boy, then the gods have shined down on us and it's to be celebrated. He says, if it is a girl, expose her to the elements. Which means take the baby out, set it in the street, and whatever happens, happens. And walk away. And lots of babies were exposed to the elements. I mean, a matter of fact, there is even one historian that says on any given night in the city of Rome, what you'll hear is just the cries of children as they're just being set out in the streets, exposed to the elements. And so what did the Christians do? They were creative. If you're going to expose them to the elements, then we'll just go around at night and pick up all the babies. And we'll raise them ourselves. I mean, it's why I love, absolutely love Mother Teresa whenever she was speaking at one of the prayer breakfasts when she was alive for our country. I believe it was the Clintons. But she comes in and she was a fiery little lady. But she comes in and she just flat out is just like, yeah, I know it's a prayer breakfast and I'm only supposed to give 20 minutes to talk. And a lot of times in your politics, I'm supposed to even like, you know, say nice things. She's like, but basically I want to talk about abortion at a Clinton prayer breakfast. Mother Teresa says, this is what her offer was. She says, if you don't want the children, just give them to me. She says, I understand that you have unwanted children in this country. And that's why that the abortion issue is such a big issue. If you don't want them, just give them to me. I'll find someone to take care of them. And it reminded me when she said it, it reminded me of the early church. If you're going to expose the children to the elements, okay. We will figure out a way to handle this. We'll just go throughout the nights and just pick them up. I mean, whenever I say the exposure was a common feature, I mean it was a common feature. We actually have certain cities where their sewers we have from archaeological digs were clogged because of the amount of babies they threw down into the sewers. This was a common thing. And as a result, the church says it's a common thing, but it doesn't have to be an acceptable thing. Here's the thing I find fascinating about abortion, and this will bleed over whenever I talk about the way that the church treated women too. Abortion in the ancient world was not as safe as abortion in the modern day. So don't pretend that it is. Modern day abortion is way more safe for the woman than it was in the ancient world. In the ancient world, it was reckless, but it had a goal and it would accomplish it. whether it be through doses of poison, like he talked about in the book, that were supposed to be at just enough dose to kill the baby but not kill the mother, or whether it be through, and this part in the book was the part where I wept, but through the needles and through the hooks and knives that at times they would just use to pull the baby out a piece at a time. What a lot of the times would happen is that the woman themselves would also be left infertile. Sometimes the woman herself would die. And the early church was not okay with that either. It's one of the things I find very fascinating about the early church's focus on abortion, protecting of children, is that it didn't just fight for the child. It fought for the child and the mother. Both. Both. Which is a novel idea. Then that's what Life Choices does. That's why I love Life Choices. Life Choices is there to protect everyone that's broken the situation. The mother, the child, and the husband. And the father. Everyone. They try to bring love. They try to bring justice to. Because if justice is setting the wrongs right or imitating Christ, you don't just pick and choose which people in the crowd you're going to fight for. You die for everyone. Even the people that hung you on the tree, you die for them too. In the early church, when it came to children, when it came to abortion, did they lobby towards Roman senators to have them help change the law? Yeah, they did. But that's not where they stopped. And that's my major frustration with the Church of America today on abortion. Is we think that our job on abortion is to vote for the right person. You know, AA calls insanity repeating the same action over and over and over, expecting a different result. And Roe v. Wade was passed in the mid-1970s. And since then, we have had pro-life presidents, a pro-life House, and a pro-life Senate. And guess what? The law doesn't change. You want to know why? It can't be changed. It can be modified, but abortion, because it went to the Supreme Court, will stay legal. So if you think that the only job that you have in abortion is to vote for the right person, number one, you're not creative enough. And number two, you've bought into the lie that that person's actually going to do what you voted them to do. You know what I mean? My whole, I don't know if I can say that or not. I think I can. Yeah, I mean, people disagree with me on a bunch of stuff. I'll let them disagree with me on this. Part of my strategy for voting for Obama both times was to go after abortion. Here is my strategy. The narrative that's always spun to me is these women just use abortion as birth control. They just go out and do whatever they want, have sex with whoever they want whenever they're pregnant, then they just kill the baby because they're evil. And I'm going, here's my problem. I've worked with too many people that have been in this situation. And I know what they're wrestling with. And a lot of times it isn't, do I want to do good or I want to do evil? Evil. A lot of times it's something more along the lines of, I'm 16. The guy that impregnated me isn't even around anymore. I don't know what to do. My parents are meth heads. I don't know where to go. If I have this baby, what will it be? What will it mean? Because I can't even feed myself, so how am I going to feed this baby? Or it's a woman that has been, you know, repeatedly left and abused. And the only way she even knows what love is, the only concept of love she even has, is through sex. And so she does sleep around to try to satisfy the yearning inside of her to return back to her king. The only way in which she knows how to get people to stay with her even for a little bit is to sleep with them. And now it's her fifth child that's going to be born, and she doesn't know how she's going to feed the other four, and she finds herself in an abortion clinic. It's usually way more messy than, do I want to choose good or want to choose evil? A lot of times it has a lot to do with, you know, economics. So part of my thought was this: what if we destroyed that narrative of saying this? It is cheap, just as cheap, for you to have the baby full term as it is for you to get an abortion. If universal health care is possible, then now money doesn't have to be the issue you're wrestling with. So then my response would be, if it doesn't cost you anything, then please have the baby and give it to the church so that we can bring it up. Like, I'll be honest with you, I understand. There's a lot of issues when it comes to people's opinions and hearts and desires on universal healthcare. The reason why I wanted healthcare is because I wanted to give people a different option than just having an abortion. And if it was just as cheap for them to have the baby, and maybe then we could bring alongside the church and some of our adoption expenses and figure out a way to minimize those, then maybe we could put a major dent in abortion by having those babies go into loving homes that are brought up in Christ. And I know, people are like, well, that's stupid, that's naive. You're right. But the bottom line is voting pro-life hasn't been working so far. We've got to get more creative. Or, this is where I'm at now, I don't even care who I'm voting for now, because that's not going to be how I'm attacking this issue. I want to start as many life choices as we possibly can. I want the church to ignite and realize we can't wait on the government to do the job for the church. The church is going to have to attack this abortion issue by loving everyone involved. Whenever a 16-year-old is pregnant, the church finds out and the church figures out a way to saturate them with love, bring them into their care, take care of the child and the child having the child. We can figure this out. We just have to be more creative. Have to be more creative. But life choices, they're doing it. And I'm going, instead of spending all of our time and effort picketing against abortion, why don't we just spend all of our time and effort raising money for organizations like that and start them all across the nation? All across the nation. But instead, we'd rather just the easy, my conscience feels good, I voted for the right person, I'm going to walk away and do nothing. Early church just wasn't that one-dimensional. The early church also did things like this. That bleeds into the next one, so we'll do this. My whole point on that is this. When it comes to children, when will the church start doing the hard work of taking care of the children instead of just passing it off to someone else? I mean, I'll be honest with you, one of the reasons why I love going to College Heights, and I'm not saying other churches in the area are not like this, I'm just saying it was not like my church growing up, and I love that this is the church that I'm at right now. It is not uncommon, it is not atypical to find foster parents or people that have adopted. It's just not atypical in College Heights. It just isn't. And foster parenting. And, I mean, it's honestly so common at College Heights that, I was just talking to one of the ministers who they were fostering a child, and now they've adopted him. And whenever I was talking to him, I wasn't like, oh my gosh, that's so amazing. I was like, dude, this is great. If you need to talk to me about what it's like to go through an adoption, especially biracial, we can talk. And if it's, but domestic, I don't really know, but I know 7 other people that do. Out of College Heights is being even birthed what's called an adoption retreat, where people that have adopted or adopted kids or people that are thinking of adopting can all come and they can share their experiences. Because adoption, while it does remedy an injustice, can also still create some identity issues, and we need to walk through these. And I'm going, I love that I go to a church that this is what we're focused on. Why? This is how you attack the problem of abortion or of children being mistreated. Because sometimes even whenever the baby is born, we think that the justice issue has stopped. No, sometimes the child maybe has been born, but they've been born into a house that's comparable to hell. What do we do then? It's like if the church would, even just 10% of the people in every church, so we tithe our people and make them foster parents that are open to adoption, there wouldn't be orphans in America anymore. But the problem is that the church, when it comes to any of these issues, we're always just looking for a way to vote so that then we don't have to do anything. Am I saying voting doesn't matter? No, I'm saying use every weapon at your disposal to attack these issues and be willing to be recklessly selfless enough to even have it cost you something more than just time in a voting line. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying don't vote for what you think will ultimately accomplish these goals too, but we cannot rely on the government to do the job of the church. It is our job to restore relationships that were broken in Genesis 3. And children are at a focal point in our country. Well, frankly, of every civilization that I can even think of, children are a key, how you treat the children is a key indicator of, well, I think even the power of the church inside the empire, personally. It's like, listen, I don't need the abortion law to be overturned in order for me to fight for the least of these. Now, if it was, sweet. But that's not happening anytime soon. So what are we going to do? Wait for the government to catch up with our morals? It's not going to happen. It never will. So we need to be the ones that even when the government is moving in this direction, we say, that's fine. We're not surprised. We will start expanding this way to help create or fix the messes that you continue to create. But fighting for just the child is not something that I can do in good conscience. I need to also figure out ways to fight for the woman, for the husband, or for the male, for the people that created the child to begin with. We've got to bring justice to all of them. Which is the second category. The early church, as Corey brought up, man, their love for women was startling. The way that they took care of women, set the wrongs right for women, was startling. I mean, I was pretty overwhelmed when Rodney Stark on page 102 describes the status of women in Athens, which would have been a more advanced society. Notice the quotation marks. But girls in Athens received literal no education. Typically, Athenian females were married at puberty or often before. Under Athenian law, a woman was classified as a child, regardless of age, and therefore was the legal property of some man at all stages in her life. Males could divorce by simply ordering a wife out of the household, but if a woman wanted a divorce, she had to have her father or some other man bring her case before a judge. Finally, Athenian women could own property, but control of the property was always vested in the male to whom she belonged. That's advanced in the ancient world. Advanced. So what did the early church do? This is what the church did. The church condemned infanticide. They said infanticide, the killing of babies, it actually hurts the mom too. Physically, which is obvious by the way in which you poison. Infertility. If her value is directly connected to her birthing of babies and she can no longer birth babies, how is she going to be treated? And then the church also tapped into this. Do you know the emotional damage that comes whenever the woman has been having a child grow in her and then it dies, even in a miscarriage? Do you know what that feels like? When my wife and I had a miscarriage between our first and second children. I mean, it was the very first time I started getting pretty upset at the pro-life people. Because we were on the verge of moving into our second trimester whenever we had the miscarriage. And my wife and I were devastated. Devastated. And people treated it like it just wasn't a big deal. I mean, there was a, oh man, I'm sorry to hear that. I literally had multiple people say, well, I mean, I'm sure you're doing okay. I mean, Sarah actually had it living inside of her. And I was kind of like, it was my baby. It's like, I mean, and so there was almost part of this where I was struggling as the male going, am I allowed to grieve this? I mean, I know that I didn't have it growing inside of me. And I know that we were on the verge of our second trimester, but I'm like, I kind of feel like I'm bummed out. I had a Christian once tell me, well, you know what this means, don't you? What? God has something better for you in store. I said, oh, explain to me what's better than my child living. And I was like, no, I'll minister to you. It was weird, though, whenever I'm going, but y'all are pro-life. And if you believe that life begins at conception, then why aren't you treating my family like we lost a baby? I don't understand this. Do you believe it's a life, a child, or not? Do you believe it's a child when it's convenient for you? Or do you believe when a child, whenever it actually is a child? No, I'm sorry. Helping me through my grieving process is not going to be convenient for you, and I apologize for that. And I know that you're going to be awkwardly squirming when you have no answers and you're going to say stupid stuff. But if we're truly pro-life, let's actually treat everything like pro-life. And the reality is, it wrecked my wife for a little while. I mean, do you know what it's like to have to go in for a surgery so they can make sure that none of the parts of the baby were left behind, that she had passed it all? That you go in having part of your baby that is no longer alive inside of you still, and when you come out of surgery, the baby that we had been celebrating for the past 3 months is no longer there. I'm going, come on. Now take it to a level where you are, picture this, whenever you were 16, before you were a Christian, you had an abortion. 20 years later, you have 2 kids, you are now a Christian, and you walk into a lobby of a church, and all the signs that you see on this particular Sunday is, abortion is murder. Those that have abortions are murderers. And I'm going, listen, I understand what your sign is saying. Your sign is saying this, that baby was a life. But you're not ministering to the woman that has been plagued emotionally from losing the baby inside of her because she was scared and didn't know what to do when she walks into your church. She doesn't have a safe place if in the church she can't be ministered to. What if that person's on the verge of becoming a Christian? And that's how they're greeted when they walk in. That happened. Like, this isn't hypothetical for me. It was a couple of years ago at a church that I was attending. And my wife and I were actually overwhelmed. I mean, we're even pro-life, but I was offended by what was happening in the lobby of my church, where there were children holding picket signs with abortion as murder. And I'm going, whoa, what's going on here? While that's happening, and I'm like, okay, whatever. At least they're not in the sanctuary. One of the people that we were working with pulled my wife and I inside, and they said, hey, listen, this young lady over here, we've been working with her. She's not a Christian yet. She just got off meth like 3-4 weeks ago, and she's starting to have tremors, starting to have withdrawals. She needs a cigarette. I need you to go to the store and buy her cigarettes now. And I was like, well, that's an interesting request that I don't normally get in a church on a Sunday. And so I went down to the store and I bought some cigarettes and came back, and my wife and I sat with her outside while she was smoking. And while she was smoking, we were just talking to her about her life. And at one point, just out of nowhere, she looked over towards the church at the lobby. And she just said, that's why I hate Christians. And I said, well, what are you talking about? She's like, that. She's like, I have a ton of friends that had to have an abortion. Granted, I'm not making a decision. I don't know if her friends, you get it? Like, I'm not even making, she said, I've had a ton of friends. And she goes, and that's why we know we're not welcome here. And I was like, what have we just accomplished? What have we just accomplished? There's got to be a better way. The early church, yeah, they were definitely against abortion, but they were not against abortion in a way that actually hurt the mother over and over and over again. They were figuring out a way to bring justice to everyone in the situation. That's why Christians also, their love for women, they condemn divorce, because women could have been treated like property, and the church says they're not property, they're made in the image of God. That's why the church condemned incest, which would happen a lot of the times whenever a brother or an uncle would decide to rape and take the female. Christians condemned marital infidelity, because if somebody was unfaithful, it was usually the male. Christians condemned polygamy, because you didn't have one woman marrying multiple men. It was one man marrying multiple women. It's why Christians also married their women at older ages. I found that particular point inside Rodney Stark startling. That a lot of the times, women were married off before they hit puberty. 11, 12 years old. Being married off to a male of 25, 26 to be their husband. That will destroy the young girl's heart, mind, and body. And the Christians say, No, we're actually, the majority of Christians, they were being married at around 18. Yeah, I know that still seems super young, but it's going, in comparison, at least an 18-year-old is able to function at some level physically, emotionally, mentally about what they're engaging. Drastically different. How do you bring justice to everything in the society that you're in? Christians were super creative. But it wasn't just women that were of childbearing years. It's even whenever women were widows, whenever they'd outlived their husbands. The Christians have an entire chapter, 1 Timothy chapter 5, that's dedicated to specific procedures inside of the church to take care of widows so that they didn't have to sell their bodies, so they didn't have to beg. The church says, no, we will take their burdens on to us. It's amazing to me the amount of programs we have in our churches today, but we don't have a widow taking care of program. It's in the Bible. If we want to return to the New Testament church, pay attention to 1 Timothy 5 and start a widow's ministry. Do you know what it's like to live with someone for 45 years, them die, and you're alone for the next 20? Do you know what it's like to never have had to pay the bills, to never have had to even worry about that stuff because that was what that person took care of, and now all of a sudden they're gone? Do you know what it's like? Emotionally, physically, spiritually, to do that. Man, I'll be honest with you, we're just terrible in America. We're terrible with how we engage the elderly, the older, on a multitude of levels. They get to a point we don't care and they don't matter because they're not young. What can they contribute? I mean, even whenever you are aging, what is it that we sell to people? Anti-aging cream. Why? Because to be old is to be bad. It means you're worthless. So people have all kinds of surgeries to look young because we've even associated youth with beauty, value. On any level, when it comes to people that age, what they struggle with the most and that what the church does a bad job of ministering to is that they don't feel like they have a place anymore. And from our worship services, to the songs we pick, to the sermons we preach, to the people that we ask to do specific tasks, to the programs and ministries we have in the church, we communicate the same thing. You're right. You're only valuable with the money that you have, and since you're on a fixed income, not so sure you have much of that anymore either. So every once in a while, we'll let you pass a tray if you don't have tremors. And every once in a while, we'll maybe let you be a door greeter if you can actually hide your oxygen. And then after that, eventually you're just gonna fall into the background. I'm not saying every church, but I am saying America as a whole, that's kind of how we treat it. But when it came to the early church, that's not the way. They had entire systems set aside for people that were aging. Come on. The church was just stinking creative. It wasn't just with those types of issues, it was even with the sick. It was startling to me to read about the prominent physician Galen. Whenever the epidemics were raging in Rome, you know, the epidemic of AD 165, the epidemic of AD 251, where literally a quarter of the empire is wiped out with the plague. And what did the famous physician Galen do? He got out of Dodge. He left. And what did the early church do? They stayed. They actually, when people, because the person had caught the plague, their family members would wheelbarrow them out and dump them in the streets so they could die away so that hopefully it doesn't contaminate the rest of the house. What did the church do? Went and picked them up and nursed some of them back to health simply by giving them the food and the water they were going to be deprived of. I love the Easter letter in AD 260 by Dionysius, one of the early church fathers. I love it. And I know you guys have read it, but I want to read it again. This is during the second plague from AD 251. And he's talking about the relief efforts of the Christians for the sick and the poor, the dying. He says, most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves and thinking only of one another. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ. And with them departed this life serenely happy. With the sick, The Christians departed this life serenely happy. Why? Well, for they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the infirmities of their neighbors. Sound familiar? For Christ takes on our infirmities. I mean, it's this. Why are they doing this? They're just acting the way Christ did, taking on the infirmities of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their place. What does that sound like? What is that? I mean, come on. You know what I mean? And then I love this. He says, the best of our brothers and sisters lost their lives in this manner. A number of presbyters, deacons, and laymen, winning high commendation, so that death in this form, the result of great piety and strong faith, seems in every way the equal of martyrdom. And I agree. 100% agree. When it comes to those, for example, it was a Christian that was on the forefront of in the last 30, 40 years of fighting against the AIDS epidemic in America. There was the Surgeon General that was appointed under Ronald Reagan. His last name is Koop. He was the very first one, and this ticked Christians off, that promoted sex education and handing out of condoms in the schools. And this was why. He said, because the reason why AIDS is spreading is because people aren't informed and because they're not having safe sex. Now, at the time, there was a lot of Christians in uproar against Koop because of this. Because they were going, but the AIDS epidemic has been put on the homosexual lifestyle as a judgment from God. And Koop says, that is not what I've been asked to do, is to give them judgment. I've been asked to bring them healing. And that's what I will do. And because of his actions, and now AIDS is back on the rise in America today. But because of his actions over the next 30 years, the AIDS epidemic in America plummeted. Why? Because he was creative. He wasn't condoning what they were doing. But he was saying was this: if for every sin that you do, you deserve a damnation in the present, then all of us are done for. All of us. He's saying, no, I will not sit back and idly sit by whenever I know the solution for what it is that's happening, even if I don't agree with what they're doing. We've got to be more creative. How is it that we're dealing, though, with things like the AIDS epidemic over in Africa? I get super annoyed whenever celebrities are known for their charitable things more than churches are. Now, there's a couple reasons for that. Celebrities, a lot of times, they like to flaunt it. And churches, that's not on their PR. I mean, what we do in the church a lot of times isn't something that, no matter how much good we do around the world, it's not going to be picked up by newspapers. That's totally true. I will also say this, though. It's also because the churches in America have this weird interaction relationship with justice issues. Over the last 50 years, we've said we are going to focus on the soul, not on the body. Because what matters most is, are they going to be living in heaven or are they going to be burning in hell? And I'm saying, listen, on a certain level, I agree with you. But Jesus didn't come just to save their soul. He came to set all of the wrongs right. Didn't he? Every wrong that's right. Satan will not have a single victory in Genesis 3, not one. So the relationship between God and humanity, salvation, will be restored so that we can be restored to ourselves, so that we can be reintroduced to creation, so that then we can restore all the broken relationship between humanity and humanity. Like sicknesses, like wars. Number one quoted passage in the early church was not Matthew 28, 18 through 20. Number one quoted passage in the early church, Isaiah. And they beat their swords into plowshares and pruning hooks, for there was no need for them anymore because the wars had ceased. And in the church, they believed that they had brought that to earth. They believed that in the church, that restoration of these broken relationships is now in the church, which is the reason why I like seeing the Christian writer Shane Claiborne in his book Irresistible Revolution. This was his response to the announcement that America was invading Iraq. He went to Iraq. as our soldiers were bombing Iraq, he was in the city to tell the Muslims that not all Christians wanted to kill them. That's a bold move. I'm not even asking what you think of the war. I'm asking this. What is the Christian response to brokenness? What is the Christian response to hate? That's what I'm asking. Not asking a political question, I'm asking a Christian one. There is a difference. I'm not weighing in on what America did. Frankly, I don't care what America thought it was doing or what it did do. I only care in as much as it affects people that don't know Jesus. So the question is, how does the church respond? Oh, and it's difficult. It's a tough conflict to wrestle through. I mean, I'll be honest. The only way that we're going to restore this is if we actually introduce people to this. I genuinely think that this chart is way more powerful of overcoming evil than any nuclear weapon ever could be. I genuinely believe that it's the transformation that's found in Jesus Christ that is the greatest power this world has ever seen, that no weapon could ever touch. I just don't know if the church always believes that. I mean, truth be told, I'm being very blunt with you here. It's the reason why the summer after 9/11, I did go to the Middle East, because I said, I don't want to fight this war with just bombs. I want evangelism to sweep the Middle East as well. Because I do not believe that bombing them is going to change their mind. But I know Jesus can. That's what he does. In the church, we're just not creative enough when it comes to the brokenness even in our world. And we use the same tactics over and over and over. In recorded history, this is in Chris Hedges' book, The War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He's quoting another scholar that I don't remember his name, but Chris Hedges says, this scholar did a survey of all of recorded civilization, thousands of years, and he only found 27 years he could find where there was not a documented war in the world. Doesn't mean there wasn't one, we just didn't have it documented. And I stopped for a moment and I just got to say, hey guys, why do we keep doing the same action thinking it's going to produce the result we all desire, and that's peace? When are we going to use a different weapon? Because guess what war has produced? More war. It's just, it always does. I'm not even talking about just war theory. I'm not asking about whether or not our government should have done this or that. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying, hey, church, if we have a problem with Muslims, you know the best way to deal with it? Love them. Serve them. Get to know them. Transform them with the love of Jesus. The best way to destroy your enemy is to make them your family. Not to kill them, because it creates more enemies. It always has. It's the same thing generation after generation after generation. We didn't create this in the last 300 years. We've just repeated it over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And Jesus comes and he says, yeah, I'm done with that. Peter, put your sword away. Tertullian says, whenever Jesus took Peter's sword away, he de-weaponized the entire church, which is fascinating. The whole point is this: how are we approaching brokenness? How are we approaching brokenness? The early church, they loved children. They loved women, they loved the sick, and they reached out to the poor. I genuinely believe that if we would attack poor, the poverty of the world, with the same intensity that we do other countries, that most of our problems could go away. And this was the lesson that was taught to me. And I've used this in a different context, but this is the one where I was like, holy cow. I was driving, we were in the Middle East, and I was driving with this taxi driver, and he was pointing out, and he was like, hey, do you see all of those? Have I told you guys this in this class? You see all of these, like, weird houses. And I was like, well, I mean, it was as far as my eye could see. And he was like, that's called the city of the dead. Have I told you guys this? He says, the city of the dead. And I said, well, what's that mean? He says, well, those aren't actually houses. He says, those are mausoleums. Those are, you know, crypts. So, you know, somebody's body goes inside of it, and they build a little house over it, and it's like a way of honoring them. And I was like, okay. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, and there are people that live in there. They're so poor. They don't have anywhere else to go. And they literally live inside of someone else's tomb. And I was dumbfounded. I'm 19 looking at this going, okay. And he goes, yeah, that's the breeding ground for Islamic extremists. And I was like, wait a minute, what? He goes, oh, they're so desperate. He's like, they're basically living in hell right now. To go be a suicide bomber, might as well. And I sat there and thought, what if we cured poverty? Like, what if we would attack the poverty in this nation instead of bombing it? Then who would the Islamic, it's not that they couldn't recruit anyone, but they would lose a major pool. If you allow people to experience heaven on earth, having your needs being provided, what does that do for them? It might subside some of their anger, some of their bitterness, some of their hatred. It might give them an opportunity to engage Christ. Early churches, the early church was creative. We just need to be more creative. Oh, whenever it comes about, even the category of not just the poor, not just the sick, but the poor. I mean, when it comes to the early church, my goodness, it's weird whenever I talk about loving on the poor, what I get accused of being, like being a Marxist or a socialist or a liberal or a hippie or a, and then I'm going, but then if that's who I am, I don't know what to do with Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4. I don't know what to do with them. Because this is what it says, not making this up. Acts chapter 2, verses 44 through 45. All the believers were together and had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as they had need. Like, what do I do with that? Or Acts chapter 4, 32 through 35. All the believers were in one heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. So in other words, they were dealing with people's physical needs. Right in the middle, you hear them talking about their spiritual needs, the preaching of the apostles, and then it ends like this. There were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as he had need. I'm like, if loving the poor puts me in the category of a communist, of a socialist, then what do I call the early church? There is a major difference, though. Communism says this, what's yours belongs to me. What community says is this, what's mine I give to you. Totally different. It's not the same. Communism forces, in a very dehumanizing way, the satisfaction of the needs of all people, but in reality, it actually hurts the needs of a lot of people. What community does is this, I will sacrifice on behalf of you because you do not have. It's Philippians 2. For Jesus didn't consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Instead, he became flesh. Instead, he became obedient to death, even to death on a cross. That's what it is. That's what Acts 2 and Acts 4 is. It's, oh, you are in need? Well, then as someone that the Lord has given something to, I use my advantages to your advantage. It's not communism, it's community. But what's crazy is that sometimes I can even talk to Christians and they're like, all right, we'll buy that. All right, maybe we'll say that that's what we'll do. My goodness, I can even read to them other stuff like Tertullian, which he talks about the budget of the early church. He says, for the funds are not taken thence and spent on feasts and drinking bouts and eating houses, but to support and bury poor people, to supply the wants of boys and girls destitute of means and parents, and of old persons confined to the house, such too as have suffered shipwreck. And if there happen to be any in the mines, or banished to the islands, or shut up in prisons for nothing but their fidelity to the cause of God's church, they become nurslings of their confession. That's what the early church went to do with their money. And eventually I can get people to say, all right, fine, they took care of other Christians that were poor. And I was like, yeah, but actually the early church did more than that. They took care of their poor, absolutely, but they also took care of the poor that wasn't a Christian. Where do I get that? I mean, that's the Emperor Julian in the 4th century, really ticked off at the growth of Christianity. And what does he say? Christians, they caused this growth by their moral character, even if pretended, and their benevolence towards strangers and care for the graves of the dead. The impious Galileans support not only their poor, but ours as well. Everyone can see that our people lack aid from us. The Christians were so lavish in their love that they didn't just take care of the poor that called themselves Christians. They took care of everyone that was in need that was around them, so much so that it shamed the Roman government for the way in which the church took care of the poor. If the church would actually tithe in America, if it would tithe, we could do away with the welfare system and the church could be the welfare system. That's a true statistic. As a matter of fact, the actual true statistic of that is if the American church would tithe, it could cure world poverty. I don't know if I'm as optimistic with the numbers as that, but I will say it could outdo the welfare system of America. And I'll be honest with you, the welfare system in America, it is not effective, not because giving money to people is bad, it's because people don't just need money. They need to be equipped in a multitude of areas, emotionally, spiritually, with actual trades. Giving them money can sometimes keep them in the same spot. What they need is holistic transformation. They need a restoration of every relationship that's broken, and only the church can give them that. But at least the very base level, if the church would tithe, we could at least have enough money to eradicate the welfare system. And I'm just talking about a tithe. I'm not even talking about sacrificial giving. Tithe should be the minimum. Problem is, when it comes to the poor in the church today, we just don't even know them. We don't know their names. We don't know their stories. We don't know them. And a lot of times we even demonstrate we just don't even care. And I call it sociologically murdering them. Whenever you drive up to somebody that's holding a sign, and what do most people do, not you, but most people, is look the other way. Don't look at them. If you don't look at them, they don't exist. And you sociologically murder them. But what happens if you look at them square in the eye? Oh, I love Acts chapter 3. Because whenever Peter and John come up on the man, lame from birth, begging at the gate called Beautiful, it says, and Peter stared at him intently and said, look at me. You are worthy to be looked at in the eye. You don't have to live under the shame. And they're like, silver and gold have I none. And people are like, see, they didn't give him money. Oh, wait for it, wait for it. But I'm going to heal your legs so you can get up and walk, so that you can actually have a family, so you can get a job. No, you're right. They didn't just give him money. They gave him a lot stinking more. They gave him dignity. They gave him a trade. They gave him an opportunity to walk into the temple and worship God. Yeah, silver and gold, they didn't give him. Why? Because that's not enough to restore what is broken in those that are in poverty. Not a single person that I know of that is in fifth grade sits there and goes, when I get older, I just want to beg for money on the side of the road. That's my goal. That's my dream. Forget being a doctor. That's what I want to do. It's going, come on, man. Do you know the story that led to this brokenness of this person or this male, this female, this family that's now on the side of the road? Do you know the story that led them there? Yeah, I have met some people that are there and they're like, man, I don't want to do anything. This is all I want to do. This is how I make my money. I have met, but I'm going, okay, I'm not concerned about what you're wanting to do now. I'm concerned about how you got to this corner. Does anybody even know their stories? Do we know their names? Man, whenever you ask them their name, they're usually overwhelmed. Try it. As you're giving them money, say, listen, I want to give you some money, but hey, I want to pray for you. I want to know your name. What's your name? I don't know. I mean, it's like at least 3 to 5 times whenever I've said that. Next thing I know, we're not only embracing, but they're weeping. Just because I asked their name. But what would we do if we would say, let's go get a meal. I just want to know your story. Where'd you come from? How are your parents? What led you to this moment? What did you want to do before this moment happened? You know, Shane Claiborne, we used to Skype with him in my Christian life class, and one time a student asked him, they said, you know, should we give money to the poor? Because I mean, we don't know if they're going to use it on drugs and alcohol. And his response was brilliant, I thought. He said two things. He said, well, first of all, it's interesting we don't ask that same question of the CEOs of Walmart. What are they going to do with the money that I give to them consistently on a weekly basis? Because he's like, they use it for drugs and alcohol too. He's like, the second thing I find interesting is you wouldn't have to guess what they're going to use the money for if you knew them. You would know what their needs were. And you would know what they would need money for. The problem is, we know the system of just giving a handout is broken, but our response to the broken system isn't to find a new one, it's just to stop giving. That's not the early church. The early church was just more creative. It just was more creative. And it's not the job of the American government, it's not the job of the Red Cross, it's the job of the church to take care of the least of these. I mean, do I need to bring back up Matthew 25? I mean, do I need to bring back up the fact that it is what it is that Christ did for us? I mean, do I need to just point back at this entire chart and realize that this moment that I'm talking to you about these issues should not shock you? This is the logical conclusion of what it means to be a Christ follower. It should be as simple as breathing, so that on the day of judgment, whenever God says, welcome into the kingdom, because whenever I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was in prison, you came and visited me. When I was a stranger, you invited me in. We go, when did we do that to you? I mean, sure, we did those things, but I never saw you. And why is that even something that we pat ourselves on the back for? That's just what it means to be a Christian on this jacked up earth. It's just what we do. Instead, not only do we not fight about it, sometimes we gloat about it, sometimes we just ignore it. Tertullian wrote this, beginning of the second century, it is our care of the helpless, our practice of loving kindness that brands us in the eyes of many of our opponents. Only look, they say, look how they love one another. I want to end with an altar call from an atheist. This is an article written by an atheist known as Matthew Paris. And it's entitled, it was from Times, Times Online. The title of it is, As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God. As an atheist, I truly believe Africa needs God. Matthew Paris. Paris is spelled with two R's. Just listen to what he says. Before Christmas, I returned after 45 years to the country that as a boy I knew as Nyasaland. Today it's Malawi. And the Times Christmas appeal includes a small British charity working there. Pump Aid helps rural communities to install a simple pump, letting people keep their village wells sealed and clean. And I went to see this work. It inspired me, renewing my flagging faith in development charities. But traveling in Malawi refreshed another belief too, one I've been trying to banish all my life, but an observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa. Sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. No, these alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. Did you catch that? It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real, and the change is good. I used to avoid this truth by applauding, as you can, the practical work of mission churches in Africa. It's a pity, I would say, that salvation is part of the package, but Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick, do teach people to read and write. And only the severest kind of secularist could see a mission hospital or a school and say the world would be better without it. I would allow that if faith was needed to motivate missionaries to help, then fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith. But this doesn't fit the facts. Faith does more than support the missionary. it is also transferred to his flock. This is the effect that matters so immensely and which I cannot help observing. First, then, the observation. We had friends who were missionaries, and as a child, I stayed often with them. I also stayed alone with my little brother in a traditional rural African village. In the city, we had working for us Africans who had converted and were strong believers. The Christians were always different. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, their faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed their converts. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world, a directness in their dealings with others. Look at me, I hear that. That seemed to be missing in traditional African life. They stood tall. At 24, traveling by land across the continent reinforced this impression. From Algiers to Nigeria, Cameroon, and the Central African Republic, then right through the Congo to Rwanda, Tanzania, and Kenya, four student friends and I drove our old Land Rover to Nairobi. We slept under the stars, so it was important as we reached the more populated and lawless parts of the sub-Sahara that every day we find somewhere safe by nightfall, often near a mission. Whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people we passed and spoke to. Something in their eyes, the way they approached you direct, man to man, without looking down or away. They had not become more deferential towards strangers, in some ways less so, but more open. This time in Malawi, it was the same. I met no missionaries. You do not encounter missionaries in the lobbies of expensive hotels discussing development strategy documents as you do with big NGOs. But instead, I noticed that a handful of the most impressive African members of the Pump Aid team, largely from Zimbabwe, were privately strong Christians. Privately, because the charity is entirely secular, and I never heard any of its team so much as mention religion while working in the villages. Oh, but I picked up the Christian references in our conversations. And one I saw was studying a devotional textbook in the car. One on Sunday went off to church at dawn for a 2-hour service. Now, it would suit me to believe that their honesty, diligence, and optimism in their work was unconnected with personal faith. Their work was secular, but surely affected by what they were. What they were was, in turn, influenced by a conception of man's place in the universe that Christianity had taught. Catch this. Those who want Africa to walk tall amid 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing the material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make the change. A whole belief system must first be supplanted, and I'm afraid it has to be supplanted by another. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. So, respond to the atheist altar call and restore broken relationships. Love you guys. See you when I see you.